Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And we're very fortunate today. We're going to be speaking to Keith Bolander. And Keith has been on the show before. Keith is an author and journalist specializing in Cuba-U.S. relations. His latest book, Manufacturing the Enemy, Media War Against Cuba, the timing of that book, it couldn't be better. And Keith, by the way, has been, also has a Twitter account, I'm happy to tell you, and I urge people go to this, @Bolo1955, because you're going to need to be updated on all this current news concerning Cuba. Keith, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me again, Phil.
You have been writing about, of course, and this recent demonstration, I want to ask you about that in a moment. There has been, I would say, more reporting than demonstrating, but there's a lot of media excitement in all the predictable capitals about it, what happened in Cuba recently. But you had already been posing the issue, writing in CubaBusiness.com, I believe it is, about the U.S. administration and its policies. So I guess let's start with the matter of what is your understanding of what has occurred? And we have not only these so-called anti-government demonstrations, I don't know what they were, and then there's been a big response, I gather. So talk about what you see there.
Sure, thanks, Phil. I mean, the protests, we all know, they took place throughout Cuba. And the perception, and I agree with it, is that it seemed to be at the start very organic, legitimate reasons for protest. I mean, there's all sorts of huge difficulties in Cuba right now. The food shortages, the economic problems. COVID cases are rising now higher than they ever have been in Cuba. So there seemed to be legitimacy to these organic protests. But after a few days, when people were able to examine what's happened and why, and looking at how the media treated it, my understanding and my position is these protests are exactly how American policy of regime change against Cuba is supposed to work, to make things so bad for the Cuban people that they'll rise up and overthrow their own government. So then you look at it from the perspective, well, how legitimate and how organic were they? I still believe there are limits of that legitimacy, but then you start understanding that, again, American policy may have played a hand in the protests. There's been reports, there's been articles about right-wing elements promoting and helping to coordinate the protests through the social media in Cuba and outside Cuba. Sites like SOS Cuba that appeared to be generated within Cuba are now, you know, there's examination and there's some proof coming out that they were outside of Cuba. So whenever anything like this happens in Cuba, you always look on at it, you know, how the Cuban people are expressing themselves and is there an American element to it? So there's always this balance. So there's definite reasons to protest in Cuba, and the government, the president Díaz-Canel agreed to that, expressed that sentiment that, yeah, there's a lot of things going wrong in Cuba right now, and the protesters, including a lot of the young people in Cuba, have the right to protest, and that the government responded, and in some ways it was a peaceful response. In some ways, in Havana there was some violent protesters, and the government responded to that violence as every government would do. So then you get to the point where how has the international media interpreted these protests? And not surprisingly, the American media, the corporate media, has formed the narrative that these protests were simply anti-government. There's been a lot of coverage that, sure, they made that the food shortages and the COVID and the economic situation, but so much of the media coverage in the United States, the corporate media coverage, started out with the anti-government aspect of it. And so it's not surprising, as corporate media always follows American policy against Cuba, promoting regime change, promoting anti-revolutionary narratives, and with an underlying of misinformation. So we're now, you know, a few days, a week after the protests, and then you're seeing how the narrative continues. It was incredible. Just if I can give you one example, the BBC covered Cuba, and they said, front page news, there's three aspects of the protests in Cuba. One is the food shortages. Two is the COVID crisis, and three is the internet and the lack of accessibility to the internet. Those were the three things they said about why the protests took place. Did they mention the American embargo? Of course not. Of course not. So corporate media in the States, in Western liberal societies, have always presented Cuba through the lens of the government's shortcomings, and that if the blockade is mentioned, it's either diminished or completely denied. And you see that absolutely happening in this situation as a response to the protests.
Yeah. I was struck by that. President Canal went and he met with people. He went directly to the area where the demonstrations were taking place and patiently talked to people and listened. And so the media here said, Canal admits that they messed up. You know, that it's like they immediately turned that into, oh, look, he's even admitting it's his fault.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, the narrative of, you know, the Cuban dictatorship. And meanwhile, he's right in among the Cuban people, you know, talking to them directly, addressing as best he can their concerns, acknowledging their complaints legitimately, and saying, we're doing the best we can. And that's something you don't see during the Black Lives Matter protests last summer in the United States. Trump was in Washington, but I don't recall him being within the protesters. I do recall him shoving them away so he could have a photo opportunity with the Bible. So the distinction between the Cuban government being, and Fidel did it too, he would go and talk to the people and address them and try and resolve the differences. Now that, you know, you can't resolve everything, you can't solve everything, but the perception, the narrative that the government is removed from the Cuban people's desires and protests and reaction is completely false. The Cuban government does their best to connect as much they can. And the Cuban government has said, we may have been failing with the voices of the streets, and we're going to try and do better, because these protests shook them up, and these protests had an effect, and they still do. You're still seeing it.
Yes. We're speaking to Keith Boulder, by the way. I couldn't remember the name. Keith Boulder. I wanted to turn you into Boulder. I'm sorry.
That's all right. I've been called worse.
You've been called worse. The book is Manufacturing the Enemy, the Media War Against Cuba, very timely for this event and what's going to unfold. You mentioned this, what he did, he spoke to, and to my knowledge, is actually the Cuban story on the COVID crisis has actually been a success. It's been a plus. But they've managed to sort of turn this around, and I don't understand how, because are the numbers in Cuba as large or larger than any of their neighbors? And has any other country in the region developed their own vaccine?
Yeah, those are good points, and it addresses the historical narrative of Cuba being held to a higher standard. So when COVID hit, you know, the Cuban government very quickly locked down the country, stopped tourist flights from coming in, and that's been a huge impact on the economy. That's one of the great reasons why the Cuban economy is doing so poorly. There's no tourism coming to Cuba. And they had it under control. They had COVID under control. A year ago, they were running maybe 1,000, 2,000 cases a day, if my memory serves. And at the same time, developing these COVID vaccines that no other country in Latin America was doing. So now Cuba has two vaccines. A million and a half people in Havana have been vaccinated. The government expects the country to be fully vaccinated in the next few months. So it's an incredible success story. But coinciding with that, their cases of COVID have gone up to 6,000 cases a day throughout the country, which is considerably worse than what the Cubans had months ago, but compared to other countries within the region in Central America, in South America, in Mexico, proportionally speaking, the Cubans are far less affected by the number of cases. But because they've gone up, it's an easy way for the media and the anti-revolutionary politicians outside of Cuba to attack the Cuban government. It is a serious concern. The Cuban government is looking to expedite the number of vaccines, but that gets back to the economic situation. They have the vaccines, they're short of syringes. And that's a reflection of the American embargo preventing the Cubans from purchasing syringes in quantities that they need. So it's always in context of what Cuban successes are in comparison to what other countries are doing, but it's easy to say, oh, they're going through this huge crisis. President Biden, in one of his speeches this week, said, oh, we're willing to donate vaccines to Cuba. They don't need vaccines. That's the last thing they need. They need the end of the embargo. They need the end of the restrictions. They need medical supplies. But that's the American attitude. And the perception of outside Cuba is, oh, they don't have vaccines. They're limiting in that capacity. They don't. They have more than enough vaccines. They just don't have some of the logistical support they need.
How is that the rollout of it? And again, how do they compare in terms of vaccines, people getting their vaccination? With their peers in the region,
very favorably. There's very few countries in Central America, in the Caribbean, and in South America that compare to the percentage of population that has been vaccinated, because those other countries have to rely on purchasing vaccines from the same manufacturers that Canada does, and the second, third world developing countries don't have the same financial access, and they're not getting. There's some countries that are, you know, vaccinating very, very small percentages of their population, where Cuba should have the whole population of 11 million people vaccinated using their own nationally developed vaccine, you know, by the end of the year, if not sooner. But again, it's easy to criticize if you're not perfect, and Cuba's, the American politicians, the American media always easily finds ways to criticize Cuba, as they hold them to a much higher standard than any other country in the region, if not the Americas, if not the
and
world.
By the way, the Cubans can't come anywhere near the hideous numbers in Los Estados Unidos, where 500,000 dead, 600, I'm sorry. I mean, and they can't even convince their own citizens to take the shot because their own citizens don't trust them. Meanwhile, they talk this way, patronizing toward Cuba, and this trick of weaponizing a sensitive issue such as vaccines, which the world needs them, but they have to turn it into, oh, we'll do that for you because you, of course, are helpless and worthless.
Yeah, absolutely, Phil. It really is incredible. You look at Florida, the cases in Florida are going up exponentially, incredibly amount. And the government's almost at a loss because they can't get the population to take the shot.
Don't trust each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's becoming very evident.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to have, you know, Cuba is, it has a really tough period in their history. The COVID, the economic situation, no tourists coming down, the food shortages, and to have American policy make it worse for them under the pandemic is really just remarkable, remarkably cynical, remarkably harmful, and it's really, really tough to understand why President Biden hasn't done anything, not one thing, and in fact, quite the opposite. He's made it clear that he's going to maintain Trump's restrictions. It's really hard to understand how we can say, on one hand, one of his speeches said, we support the Cuban people. Well, no, you don't. If you support the Cuban people, end the embargo, end the blockade. To think otherwise is just the most cynical political rhetoric you can think of.
Yeah. We're speaking to Keith Bolander, and at Bolo 1955, and you posted something nice from Max Blumenthal apropos of the vaccine developed by Cuba. He pointed out, I think it was Bloomberg that ran a headline that Cuba was now resorting to homemade vaccines. Homemade. It's like, as Blumenthal said, like they made it in a garage. But, you know, Cuba's a member of the World Health Organization. We're not playing games here. All these things are being treated by their fellow scientists. America's in a madcap Mars world, but homemade. How about that?
Yeah, that's a perfect example of how words have direct effect on how the reader or the media consumer interprets things. So exactly as you said, when one of the most, you know, highly respected media publications says homemade, immediately the reader or the consumer thinks, oh, it's illegitimate. It doesn't have any value.
Yeah.
So it's incredible how the media continues to utilize words to establish ground rules for the reader to understand what's negative and what's positive. And Cuba is a perfect example how the media have always used terminology to create anti-revolutionary biases, misinformation, and they still do it to this day.
That's what they're good at. The weasel word.
Yeah.
The qualifier.
Absolutely.
Allegedly stable Cuban society. You know, that kind of, they're just sort of working it in.
It's one of the media narratives was, oh, this is, you know, these protests are so unprecedented that they never have protests in Cuba. They have protests fairly often, and the perception is protests are illegal. No, the protests aren't illegal. And there's many examples of people protesting in the streets about government shortages and shortcomings, but the media just plays into the narrative that the Cuban people are completely under the thumb of the government and they can hardly wait to overthrow them. And here's a chance to do exactly that. And it all gets back as we started, the connection and the support of the media with American foreign policy of regime change. That's all it comes down
to. Yes, the answer is always regime change. You finish third in 200 meters, the answer is regime change. You know, again, it's Keith Bolander. I got to keep saying I'm really glad about your Twitter account at Bolo 1955. I noticed that you've been very rightly hammering the point, blockade and 184 countries. That I would like to tell Chrystia Freeland and Mr. Blinken and all these people, that seems to be an international community. I often hear about that. When it's Americans in Denmark, it's, you know, this time it actually is saying in this blockade, which is, what is it? It started in 1962. Can you tell, and to clarify our language, we have blockade and then we have sanctions. And under Trump, it was 242 new sanctions. First of all, what is the blockade and its link, for example, to not being able to get syringes?
The Americans will reference the embargo, the economic embargo the United States has against Cuba. And again, the media references that with the implication that it's only the United States deciding not to have trade relations with Cuba. The Cubans and others, including myself, refer to it as a blockade because it has so much extraterritoriality effects to American law. So there are Canadian companies that are being prohibited from doing business in Cuba because of American laws, Canadian subsidiaries of American companies, subsidiaries of American companies around the world. Not only that, the Americans put just unbelievable pressure on other countries not to trade with Cuba. You know, as part of the Helms-Burton Act, if a shipping company trades with Cuba, they're prohibited from docking in American ports for 6 months. So there's all this other international influences that the Americans, the most powerful economic nation on earth, that are putting pressures on other countries not to trade with Cuba. So one of the arguments that the right has, oh, well, Cuba can trade with anyone else in the world. Yeah, they can under unbelievable, more complicated conditions, and they can't access world international financing institutions. So there's all these incredible complexities for Cuba doing trading and economic relations with the rest of the world because of the American policies. So just really quickly, President Obama in 2014 announced a normalization process with Cuba. Nothing to do with the blockade. He was not going to even look at ending the blockade, but he did institute a number of presidential authority to ease some of the restrictions, so Americans could travel to Cuba easier under the different licensing. American businesses were allowed to come in. American cruise companies were allowed to do business in Cuba. So there was an opening. It was minor, but it had a really positive effect on the economy of Cuba, particularly Havana. And then when Trump came in, he ended all that normalization process and then made things worse. He's added like 200 additional restrictions, building on the blockade itself. So things like ending the cruise lines to the American cruise line companies going to Cuba, they're no longer allowed to it. American businesses that were doing businesses with Cuban hotels, that ended, making it harder for general American tourists to come to Cuba, restricting economic access for the Cuban government. And then the last thing he did just before he ended office, he put Cuba back on the states that sponsor terrorism, which is the most hypocritical thing you could do because it's the Cuban people that have been subject to decades of terrorism by Cuban American organizations in Florida. So Trump putting Cuba back on, which Obama had ended, had a whole series of additional economic restrictions that the Cuban government had to deal with. So the blockade has always been there for 60 plus years. Obama eased some certain aspects of it. Trump made it worse. And Biden, who promised on his campaign trail to roll back the Trump restrictions, has done nothing, not one thing.
Yeah. That, by the way, this is Keith Bollinger. And in CubaBusinessReport.com, I believe, you wrote about this. And I really recommend people go to that site and to Bolo 1955 and read it, because those details, Keith, are very important. I mean, because we sort of fall into a pattern of saying blockade, sanction, but very specifically, these are heinous things, and particularly when you look at them. I mean, it appears to me they're trying to develop a situation where they will try to prevent tourism, which is very essential to the Cuban economy. And on the matter of taking Cuba off the, putting it back on rather, the terrorist list, you're actually authorizing terrorism, aren't you? Because if you say it's a terrorist government or a government, then that permits people to form terrorist groups. They will call them freedom, whatever, liberation, but you're actually inciting them to engage in violence against Cuba.
Yeah. The certain Cuban American organizations never needed that designation to commit acts of terrorism against Cuba in the 60s and the 70s, but more so that relisting terrorists on the states that that sponsor terrorism, which is just a ridiculous designation. It's completely arbitrary on the American side. People can argue that America has often been involved in acts of terrorism. It really does have serious economic consequences, because internationally, countries can't conduct certain economic interactions with those countries that have been listed. So again, it gets back to, here's Cuba trying to deal with COVID. Here's Cuba trying to deal with the ending of American tourism coming to Cuba. Here's Cuba dealing with all this other stuff. And the last thing Trump does is give Cuba another kick, saying, I'm going to relist you on the states that sponsor terrorism, to make it even harder to come out to deal with the economic difficulties this country is going through. Yeah. Trump, you expect, okay, Trump was, you know, more aligned to the hard right Cuban American community. He needed that vote to win Florida. Biden doesn't.
Yeah.
Biden has certain Cuban American in his party, like Bob Menendez.
His base is liberal Cubans or liberal people.
Exactly. And a strong argument is Biden doesn't need and will never get the hard right Cuban American community in Florida, so he'll never win that vote. So again, as I mentioned before, he made it very clear on this campaign trail that one of the things he was going to do is sign a number of presidential authority orders eliminating Trump's restrictions, including the listing of the states that sponsor terrorism. And we're all waiting for it. So for him to come out now, for Biden to come out now in response to the protests saying, yes, we support the Cuban people. No, I'm sorry, you do not, Mr. President.
Well, you know, I can't resist asking you about this. Apropos, because again, we're talking about media and how and the support for the most dangerous elements in Miami. Of all places, I saw Rick Sanchez on RT and giving his analysis, and he said, "Well, the problem in Cuba is this, you know, socialism and its economic system." He said, "The sanctions don't matter." And the blockade doesn't matter because it's their own fault. So here's my question. If that's true, why don't you lift the sanctions?
That is the question. That is the question I ask everyone. So if the sanctions
don't do with it, so then why don't you lift them? Go ahead, let's find out.
So what, and that's the Cuban government position. The Cuban government has said during the Obama opening, they said, fine, prove that we're incompetent. Prove that we can't handle things and eliminate the excuse of the Cuban government, because the Americans say, oh, the Cuban government always blames the embargo. So eliminate the embargo and say, okay, you guys have failed without it. But the Americans don't want that, because they absolutely know lifting the embargo is the lifeline that the Cuban government and the rest of the world needs. And the proof is when Obama eased the restrictions, the Cuban economy changed, the Cuban government attitude changed, economic reforms were in place. I was in Havana, the people in Havana were benefiting tremendously from the influx of American tourism and American businesses. And the American businesses wanted to come, and the rest of the world was dealing with Cuba on a different level. So for anyone who says that the blockade, the embargo, whatever you want to call it, has no effect, it's simply not true. And the exact response is, then what's it there for?
Yes. Of course, Rick Sanchez is a Miami Cuban himself, but it shows they've been, drinking their own Kool-Aid or something. They could just rhetorically say that without noticing an obvious problem with what they're saying.
But they have to deny it. They cannot admit that the embargo has an effect, because it legitimizes the Cuban government position. And also reveals just how damaging the embargo is. It affects every aspect of Cuba's life. And the other thing the United States is absolutely brilliant at denying, ignoring, is that the vast majority of the Cuban people do understand that the embargo has an effect. Pro anti-government Cubans all say end the embargo, because it will reveal the validity of the Cuban government or not. But the Americans cannot, it's impossible politically for them to admit it. And unfortunately, I don't see the embargo ending. I was just hoping that Biden would at least turn back to what Obama was trying to do and proceed from there. But I'm not too hopeful about that right now.
Yeah, I guess we, to speak big politics, the geopolitical environment is changing. I wonder what you think of this. A foreign minister of Venezuela was giving an analysis of what's going on. And he says, in fact, progressive forces of South America are rallying stronger than any time in decades. I mean, I'm hearing that a Chilean communist is running first in the polls on who will be the next president of Chile. The president of Mexico spoke out strongly in support of Cuba. The attempt to overthrow the Bolivian government collapsed because the Bolivian people wouldn't accept. So I don't know.
In Argentina, look what's happening in Argentina as well.
Are going to prosecute
the
former president for illegally passing arms to that junta in Bolivia that collapsed. One assumes maybe that Biden and his friends, certainly the intelligence Pentagon group, they're kind of like rust, right? They don't sleep. I mean, Biden goes somewhere for a meeting. Meanwhile, they're trying to overthrow the government of Cuba. They're trying 100%. To overthrow the government of Argentina.
Yeah, I don't. I hope there is another pink wave because, you know, there was a number of very strong left governments in Latin America. And then the tide turned where right-wing political forces came into it. And now it does seem to be moving the other way. And that's a huge help for Cuba. The more international allies they have, the easier it is to put pressure on the Americans. Not that they respond to it, as we, you know, you mentioned before, the United Nations vote once again, you know, 182 nations voted against the embargo, 2 voted for it, and the Americans just shrugged their shoulder and said, well, we really don't care what the world thinks. This is a domestic policy situation between Cuba and the United States, which reveals their arrogance, that they still haven't gotten over the fact that Cuba wants, you know, has won and wants to maintain their independence.
Yeah, and they remain an inspiration throughout the hemisphere. When the Cubans go anywhere in South America, there's a lot of respect.
Very much so. It's
a Bolivar phenomenon. Fidel has that kind of name. They call it name recognition.
Well, and you look at the amount of medical teams that the Cuban government has sent out to other countries to help combat COVID. And the other countries, for the majority, have welcomed them wholeheartedly and appreciate their efforts. And the American side is, oh, you know, this is something wrong. This is something bad that the Cubans are doing. It's really consistently remarkable how anything the Cubans do that the rest of the world sees as positive, the Americans just don't want to recognize or give any credit to the Cuban efforts.
And, you know, I have to raise something. Because our leaders here, Ottawa, have a habit of echoing, in a sense, the Americans. And they love to say, we want an international order, a rules-based order and law. The sanctions are illegal, right?
Yes.
They're so proud of themselves saying sanction, sanction. None of that actually has any import beyond the continental USA.
Yeah, absolutely. The United Nations has condemned it. International legal advice has come out very strongly that there's no legal basis for the United States embargo blockade against Cuba and hasn't been.
And but again, not bring itself ever to differ, right? I don't remember them ever saying anything about it.
I think you're right. But I mean, the American attitude is, well, it's none of anyone else's business. It's between us and Cuba. And until Cuba comes back and apologizes for the revolution, we're going to keep this blockade on. And unfortunately,
that's another point I want to make sure I get to with this about what they consider the way to tar, even their idea of negotiations. But I can't move on without asking you also on the level of legality and arrogance and almost borderline madness. The mayor of Miami, a major American city, called for the bombing of Cuba. Now, I don't really don't think you can get away with that, actually. I mean, in the sense that that is the foreign policy of a government is the hand of the foreign policy. I mean, for a leading American citizen to talk about bombing another country, that should be condemned internationally. People should speak out.
Yeah, yeah, that's. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, Miami often thinks that they run America's foreign policy against Cuba, and often they do. But that was remarkable. So here you have a country that has protests, and one of the first reaction is let's invade them or let's bomb them. Well, then what about Colombia? Colombia's been having protests for weeks, if not months. Peru, European countries have protests. We have protests here. We have protests here in Toronto. It's like, okay, but in Cuba, if you have a protest, we're going to invade you. That's the mentality.
Yeah, it's raining. We're going to invade you.
It was incredible to have the media ask that question or have the Miami mayor express those sentiments, however he couched it. And for the media to not just to say this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. No, it's actually according, you know, for the American policy and American corporate media, you know, that could be an option, you know, because we've had some protests in Cuba. Let's go invade them and let's take them over again and let's bomb them. It's remarkable. It's absolutely stunning.
And that's really where I would hope the Canadian politicians would look at each other and at least say something about what is this mad rhetoric? I mean, can't the Americans calm themselves down? Can't they enter into ordinary relations with other people?
Well, it's interesting because when you hear that, when the Miami mayor, who wasn't born in Cuba, but it comes from a Cuban-American family, says that, you know, the rest of the world can shrug their shoulders and say, he's just, you know, it's just rhetoric, don't take it seriously. The Cuban government does take it seriously. Whether they're right or wrong to take it seriously, they do take it seriously based on the history.
They have to.
They have to. They can't afford not to.
And any self-respecting country would tell the mayor to pipe down. He's not. They would say, "Listen, you know, you don't make our policy. Your kind of talk could create a problem. We run the policy." But instead, it's a madhouse.
Yeah, exactly.
Every tin pot mayor or wild governor can shoot his mouth off, so long as he's aiming at somebody who's not an American. We're speaking to Keith Bowen.
Well, and then you get this situation where shortly after you had a group of Cuban Americans saying, okay, we're going to get in boats. We're going to go to Cuba. We're going to just go right to the border of the international waters with food and medicine, but we're also going to be armed.
Yes, exactly.
So then,
Venezuela. They went to the Colombian border.
Exactly. And the Cubans have had experience with that type of provocation, and so the Cuban government has to take these situations really seriously if no one else does, and it's a sad situation.
And on this abusing the rules, I believe I saw it at. At your Twitter account, and which is at Bolo 1955, the United States prevented Venezuela from being able to use its bank account, I guess, to buy vaccines from the COVAX UN or World Health Organization account. So they're getting in the way of a simple humanitarian step. I wish that maybe they could go to the world court, but I mean, this again, I don't understand all these self-respecting democracies, the UK, France, Canada, standing by with their mouth shut while that happens.
Yeah, that was remarkable. I read that and I couldn't, it's shocking how low American foreign policy will go to prevent a country like Venezuela who wanted to buy, who also, my understanding is they paid a majority of the funds necessary to purchase vaccines for COVAX, and the Americans prohibited them from obtaining the vaccines. I just don't understand the lack of humanity. And it's particularly frustrating, hypocritical, when the United States, you know, presents themselves as they often do, as the exceptionalism, as the, you know, the beacon of the on the hill, and you know, talking about other countries condemning them for human rights abuses, and meanwhile they have the audacity to do this.
It couldn't be more blatant than that.
Yeah.
Getting between someone who needs medicine for a disease that threatens all of humanity. So in other words, you're actually helping yourself if you help him get that medicine. But this is a case of, what they say, burning down a house to boil an egg?
Yeah, for purely political
this
reasons.
Is Keith Ballinger. Hey, Keith, we're taking you along, but you've got so much information. I got to take the opportunity. My impression is that Canada, while it's never bought totally into and is respected quite a bit for continuing relations with Cuba, sort of on an even course. But I've heard that, for example, they're making it more difficult to get a visa to come to, for a Cuban wanting to travel, that they have to go, I've heard they have to go to Mexico City to get their visa.
Well, that's the America. That's one of the things that Trump imposed, one of the restrictions.
Canada went along?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they did. My understanding is it's not that complicated. I think there's still, although the Canadian government did reduce some of its embassy staff.
Didn't they have a cricket column? They had headaches from crickets?
Based on the sonic attacks. The Americans suffered first and the Canadians suffered, but it could quite possibly. So now the Cubans have no access for visa consul services in the embassies. So they have to go, like you said, to Mexico and a third country. And, you know, the economic hardship on that is next to impossible.
Yeah, jackal diplomacy.
Yes, very much so. I mean, the Canadians have always maintained relations with Cuba, so I certainly give them credit for that. Regardless of what government has been in Ottawa, they've always maintained interchange with Cuba is much more effective than the American policy. But more often than not, Canada has gone on with the criticism of the Cuban system and certain aspects that they just, you know, they misinterpret as well. But for the most part, at least Canada has engaged Cuba at a level that the Americans just won't even contemplate.
Yeah. Again, it's Keith Ballinger. By the way, three great books, Voices from the Other Side, Cuba Under Siege, and you could put an asterisk behind that because it's getting worse in many ways. And of course, Manufacturing the Enemy. The media war against Cuba, that's published in 2019. This last matter of they're doing, they've decided to put a kind of barrier. I noticed when they talked to the Islamic Republic of Iran, they talked to China, and they've been doing also with Russia. They're starting this game of, first, you have to make a concession to us. Then we do this. So, but this wasn't, you know, when they were headed down the friendly road with Obama, that part had been passed. That'd been agreed. So, I mean, it's very vindictive and also insulting. How can any self-respecting sovereign government say, so you send me a list of things I have to do, and then you talk to me. Is that right?
That's exactly how America has dealt with Cuba. Whenever there's discussions about ending the embargo, the Americans say, well, first you have to, you know, we can't allow any Castro to be head of the government. We can't allow your system of government to maintain. We can't allow your economic programs to maintain. We can't allow this. We can't allow that. We can't allow that. And then maybe we'll talk about ending the embargo. Under Bush, I think it was, there was a policy called Commission for Assistance of Free Cuba that outlined specifically what conditions the Cuban government had to meet before the Americans would even enter negotiations with ending the embargo. So, of course, the Cuban government said, well, yeah, thanks, go away. You either respect us or you don't, and you never have. And Obama did, to a certain extent, enter into the normalization process or the opening up of Cuba and the United States without setting preconditions. There was a lot of bilateral discussions talking about, you know, the claims of confiscated properties on the American side, the cost of the embargo on the Cuban side. But there seemed to be at least a sense of, we'll discuss these issues without preconditions. But Obama made it very clear, there's no way we're going to talk about any of the embargo until these other conditions are met. So there was always that underlying conception of the Cubans had to give up everything. So it's like, if I'm going to use the analogy right, so the kidnapper says to his victim, you have to agree to all these things before I let you go. Meanwhile, it's the kidnapper who bears the most criminal responsibility, but the Americans have turned it on its head and said, we're the kidnapper, and we're not going to even negotiate the hostage release until you give us everything you want. And then we'll talk about maybe releasing the hostages. So the Americans have always been under the condition, you have to give up everything. The Cubans have to give up absolutely everything until we even contemplate negotiating the end of the embargo. And the Cuban side obviously is like, well, no, we're not giving up anything. You end the embargo because it's illegal, it's criminal, and it's hurting our people. Then we'll talk about anything you want to talk about. So this is how the Americans negotiate with their self-declared adversaries.
Yes, they're the exception. And by the way, when the Cuba says that, they're really speaking for all sovereign countries in the world.
Absolutely.
Every country, Philippines, Venezuela, Argentina, they say, that's exactly right. You can't, you know, if you want to talk to a sovereign country, you do it with respect. And you say, so let's see what we can negotiate.
But the Americans are even hypocritical to that point. They after the Vietnam War, the Americans imposed an embargo almost as extensive against Vietnam. And then in 20 years, Bill Clinton eliminated it completely without any conditions, and then said, okay, now you're a favored trading nation. So Vietnam and the United States have absolutely no problem. My understanding is Vietnam is still, you know, similar political, economic structure as Cuba, but there seems to be a little difference there. So then you look at why. Well, even though the Americans lost the war in Vietnam, they never possessed Vietnam. Americans lost the revolution in Cuba, but they actually had possession of Cuba for 60 years prior to the revolution. So they still haven't gotten over that and you wonder if they ever will.
Yes. This is a mark on their escutcheon, as they say. they do not like being humiliated, and that Fidel did it without, and he didn't mean to hurt their feelings. He likes baseball, he likes Americans, but he said, you have to excuse me, I have self-respect.
And the Americans haven't forgiven the Cubans for that. Or they haven't forgiven the Cubans who still support the revolution. And there's Cubans who don't support the government, but still support the concept of Cuban patria, Cuban homeland, and Cuban sovereignty. Yeah. And the Americans don't understand that. There's still so much intentional misunderstanding, because if the Americans understood that, then they'd have to rethink their policy, and they never will.
That's very... It's profound stuff, and we've been talking to Keith Bolander at Bolo, 1955, and of course, three great books, Voices from the Other Side, Cuba Under Siege, Manufacturing the Enemy, the Media War Against Cuba, and the editorials you've been writing in CubanBusinessReport.com. I really urge people to go to those sites. Keith, thank you very, very much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Phil.